This is The Book in the Spade, a report on the latest discoveries and developments in biblical archaeology. Here's your host, Gordon Govier.
Archaeologists usually have some idea of what to expect when they start digging a site, but they never know until they start digging. And whatever it is, they have a responsibility to do it right. Which brings us to University of North Carolina archaeologist Jody Magnus, when she started to dig at a site overlooking the northwestern shore of the Sea of Galilee.
I think it was the last time we talked, you suggested that synagogues in the Galilee have been misdated. Dated earlier than they should be. And you were going to partially excavate a synagogue and come up with better data to help solve that problem.
Yeah.
And that didn't quite go as planned.
Well, it actually went better than planned. So you're right. I still hold that position, by the way. I still hold the position that the so-called Galilean-type synagogues, which are these monumental buildings like the synagogue at Capernaum, which many of your listeners are probably familiar with, that these buildings have been dated by archaeologists too early. Traditional dating is 2nd and 3rd centuries AD. And I think that they date mostly to the latter part of the 4th century, but especially the 5th and 6th centuries. I set out to try and sort of establish whether I'm right or wrong by excavating my very own Galilean-type synagogue at a site called Hukok in Galilee. And by the way, for your listeners, if they want to look it up, that we have a website, a dig website, hukoq.org, H-U-Q-O-Q.org. You can see all the information there. We started excavations in 2011. We've been excavating every summer since then, except the last two summers due to COVID. And we have been coming up with the remains of a monumental Galilean-type synagogue building, which on the basis of the evidence that we have so far, which includes pottery coins and radiocarbon dating, appears to have been built in the early 5th century, so a little bit after 400 AD. But what's so amazing about this building is that instead of being paved with flagstones, like the typical Galilean-type synagogues like Capernaum, for example, it is paved with mosaic floors, and not just any mosaic floors that are divided into a series of panels that depict, for the most part, biblical stories. And we have scenes of Samson and Jonah and the building of the Tower of Babel and Noah's Ark, the parting of the Red Sea. So it's absolutely extraordinary. The mosaics have definitely pushed the project in a slightly different direction. My original goal, do a 5-year project, excavate half the synagogue, find the dating evidence, and then, you know, let it be. And somebody else then could come along and excavate the rest and see if I'm right or wrong. But with the mosaics, we've now are committed, of course, to excavating the entire building. And we've got about 2/3 to 3/4 of it excavated so far. So we still need about 2 to 3 more years to finish it up.
So these are biblical scenes that rival the scenes at Dura Europus, another synagogue?
Yeah, actually, Dura Europus, which is a synagogue in Syria, and dates earlier, it dates to the 3rd century AD, has a spectacular decorative program of colorful wall paintings with biblical scenes on its walls, but not the floor. Our synagogue is analogous in having this amazing program of biblical stories depicted, but in the mosaic floor, not on the walls. And being located in Israel, in Galilee, and not in Syria. So basically being a Palestinian synagogue and not a diaspora synagogue. There are also differences in the way some of the same scenes are portrayed. So at Dura Europus, there is a scene of the parting of the Red Sea. We have a scene of, it's not exactly the parting of the Red Sea, it's Pharaoh's soldiers being swallowed by giant fish in the Red Sea. That's what we have. So there are some of the same stories that are depicted in both synagogues, but they're depicted differently and they're depicted in different media and they date to different periods. But in terms of this idea of having a synagogue building decorated with an array of colorful panels depicting biblical stories, the two synagogues, yes, would be analogous in that regard.
The art form, mosaic art form, flourished in the Byzantine period, this time that we're talking about. What was it about mosaics that made them so popular?
Actually, mosaics flourished through the Roman period in general, right? I mean, we have earlier mosaics if you go back to the Roman world. But it's true, they're very popular in late antiquity, let's say the 4th, 5th, and 6th centuries, when one of the major mosaic centers was Antioch in Syria. In Galilee, we're kind of adjacent to one of the great centers of mosaic production. That's not to say our mosaics were produced by anybody from Antioch, but we're in an area that had a lot of mosaics. And in fact, if you look at the Byzantine churches over in Jordan on the other side of the Dead Sea, they're also decorated with a lot of mosaics, right?
So, including the famous Marble Map.
That's right, exactly. So The thing about mosaics in these kinds of buildings, whether they're churches or synagogues, is that you could use the mosaics to get your message across, right? To use these biblical stories in order to convey your basic underlying message of whatever it was, salvation or, you know, whatever. Use the stories to help educate the worshipers who came in, perhaps also to complement the liturgy that was conducted inside the building. When you walk on them, they're pretty durable. That's also good for a public building. There are a number of reasons why mosaics were popular, but we happen to be in an area where mosaics were common through late antiquity.
One of the things we talked about in a previous conversation was the fact that some of these mosaics are a zodiac design. Mm-hmm. That would seem unusual in a Jewish synagogue.
We have a zodiac. We have a heliozodiac cycle at Hukok. Like everything else, it's a little different from the others that are in ancient synagogues, but we now have 10 ancient synagogues in Israel that have a heliozodiac cycle. We don't have any in diaspora synagogues, at least not so far. But in the land of Israel, we have 10 ancient synagogues that had a heliozodiac cycle. This is one of the very interesting things, and there's been tons written on it about what was it about the heliozodiac cycle that was so meaningful to these congregations. I'm not going to answer your question farther than that because that would take like another couple of hours. Pretty much every single scholar that you ask has a different opinion. I had my say. I published a long article in Dumbarton Oaks Papers in 2005. It's very interesting that we do not find this motif in churches. So whereas Jews and Christians used some of the same biblical stories to decorate their public buildings, whether it's the story of the offering of Isaac by Abraham or the story of Daniel in the lion's den or whatever, the heliozodiac cycle is not found in churches. It's particular to synagogues, and again, so far to synagogues in Palestine. So why exactly that is, again, it depends on how you interpret the significance of the motif.
You're listening to an excerpt of my Upwards podcast interview with Jody Magnus, immediate past president of the Archaeological Institute of America.
Well, let's bring our listeners up to date with what you're working on now, which is a book on Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Why do we need another book on Jerusalem?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You need to ask the editor at Oxford University Press who pestered me for years to write this book. But I resisted because Jerusalem is so complex. My previous book was about Masada. Masada is a fairly easy story to tell. It's nice and neat. It has a beginning, middle, and end. It's one site with basically very easy levels that you can go through. Masada is finite, but Jerusalem is infinite. There's no end to Jerusalem. And anybody who knows anything about Jerusalem, and this includes me, would never agree to write a book about it. This is a book that's not a specialist book. It's a trade book, so it's aimed at a non-specialist audience. So to try and write a book that sort of covers the complexity of the city throughout time for people who are not specialists, this is a really daunting task. And that's why I resisted for a very long time. At some point, I looked around and I looked at the books that are out there that in this genre, in this kind of category about Jerusalem. For the most part, they're written by people who are not specialists in the field. They're not archaeologists. They're not people who have excavated in Jerusalem. They don't specialize in the archaeology and history of Jerusalem, which is not to say that those books aren't necessarily good books, right? But they weren't written by people who actually know the city the way that I know and the way that other archaeologists who work in Jerusalem know it. So after that, I thought, well, shoot, if they can write a book about Jerusalem, I can write a book about Jerusalem. And maybe, you know, we should have a book written by somebody who actually knows all of this stuff as intimately as at least some of it I know. So I agreed to do it. Right now, it's tentatively titled Jerusalem Through the Ages, starting at the beginning, and have each chapter focus on a particular date in Jerusalem's history, a sort of transition date in Jerusalem's history. What did Jerusalem look like on the eve of the Muslim conquest or, you know, whatever? And then to take it up to the Crusades. Thanks to the pandemic, I have to say, I was able to get a head start on this project because my original idea was that I was going to write it this year during my sabbatical year. And it's a good thing that that did not happen because there's no way I could have written it in a year. There's absolutely no way. And so this was actually one of the benefits of the pandemic. After I finished my revision of the Qumran book, I got started on the Jerusalem book. Because it's so long right now that I probably won't take it up to the Crusades, I'll probably end it with Charlemagne's time. That is around the year 800 in the early Islamic period. And that's the chapter that I'm working on right now. So I'm struggling right now with trying to explain the complexity of the Dome of the Rock, which is extremely complex, and the other monuments on the Temple Mount or Haram, as it's called in Arabic. And at the moment, I'm actually submerged in a debate over these monumental buildings that were discovered by Israeli archaeologists in the late 1960s around the western and southern sides of the Temple Mount. And what are they, and what is their correct date? It is going to be much more complex and more technical than my Masada book, just because it's impossible not to. But I'm hoping that I'll be able to explain things in a way that people who are not specialists will understand, and also that won't put them to sleep as they're reading it, with lots of illustrations so they can follow along. Because I do think it's important to understand the background to these debates, because these are debates that are central to claims that are made about Jerusalem, whether it's, did David have a palace in Jerusalem, and who has the rights to certain parts of the city, historical rights. Archaeology is always cited one of the things that legitimizes these kinds of claims. And I think it's important for people to understand that the archaeological evidence is not unequivocal, that it's a matter of interpretation and how you interpret. The claims are not necessarily based on the most reasonable or highly supported interpretation of the evidence. So I'm going to try and get that across to readers. We'll see how it turns out.
Sounds fascinating. I'm looking forward to it. It's my understanding that the Dome of the Rock, this famous Islamic building, is actually in the design of a Christian church.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So a number of scholars have pointed this out. Again, there's, you know, tons of literature on, that's another problem with dealing with Jerusalem. Every single thing has like tons of scholarly literature. So, of course, the Dome of the Rock being, I think, the most prominent monument in Jerusalem has been the focus of a lot of attention. Already, many scholars have pointed out the similarities between the layout and the decoration of the Dome of the Rock and some contemporary Christian churches, primarily the rotunda of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is the circular structure that enshrines the tomb, but also other churches that are analogous to that. We have the structure inside the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, which encircles the grotto. There's a church just outside Jerusalem, the Kathisma Church, which also has this octagonal layout. There's no doubt that at least one of the sources of inspiration for the Dome of the Rock were these sort of what we call centralized churches in Jerusalem and its environs, which were used to enshrine a central focal point, usually a focal point for pilgrimage. Often these buildings are described as martyria, because in the Christian world, they enshrined a site associated with a martyr, meaning somebody who had testified to the truth of Christianity, right? Who was a witness to the truth of Christianity. This kind of structure then clearly inspired the layout and decoration of the Dome of the Rock, which enshrines this outcrop of rock, the foundation stone. And one of the big questions is, what was the significance of that rocky outcrop at the time the Dome of the Rock was built? Because later, certain traditions arise and become associated with that rock. But what were the associations with that rock at the time the structure was built in the 7th century? So there's a huge amount of literature on that.
Something to look forward to, a book on Jerusalem by Jody Magnus, Keenan Distinguished Professor of Teaching Excellence in Early Judaism at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. On October 23rd at Upper House on the University of Wisconsin campus, Jody Magnus will be lecturing on her excavations at Hukok, the Galilean synagogue that she discussed at the beginning of this program. We have a link to all of the details of this lecture on our website at radioscribe.com. This conversation is courtesy of Upper House and their Upwards podcast. At our website, you can also find details of our Holy Land tours coming up in 2022, one to Israel and one to Greece and Turkey. That's all at our website at radioscribe.com. I'm Gordon Govier. Join us again next time for more Backgrounders on the Bible through Biblical Archaeology on The Book and the Spade.
The Book and the Spade is produced by Scribe Media. For information on Biblical Archaeology resources or obtaining a copy of this program on CD, go to our website at radioscribe.com.